This lecture, thank you, Susanna. This lecture comes out of years of frustration and phone calls along the lines of, help me, my seeds won't germinate. Yeah? And so rather than giving you cutting edge stuff, which I can, all right, and people will know that I don't need to be terribly provoked, I thought that I would review for you or introduce you to a logical way to deal with seeds that don't germinate when you put them in water and imbibe them, and you say, oh, I should have nice plants, all right? This becomes an issue for graduate students who want seedlings or plants to put in a wearing blender and grind up, or liquid nitrogen. But from a practical point of view, dormancy, a failure of a viable seed to germinate, impinges and creates non-uniform seedling establishment of a population and slows down the speed of germination of that overall population. For those of us that are interested in restoration or seed or gene conservation, dormancy can be an issue because we would like to know before we spend valuable time and space on storing seeds, we would want to know that they're alive, right? No sense in storing dead seeds.
Sure.
Well, for you, all right? The lunatic fringe in Fort Collins, you know, it's Colorado, you know, they have strange things there. Most people would not be interested, except for Dr. Walters, in storing dead seeds. We store dead seeds too, Spartina, one of our favorite species. So if you're involved with agricultural restoration or gene conservation or plant establishment, dormancy is not your friend. The plant's friend, but it's not your friend. All right. But, so here's the basic problem. Oh dear, your seed doesn't germinate. Before you go to the trouble of databases and send your students off to Web of Science or Google Scholar or any of the resources that I'm going to tell you about today, you really need to ask a fundamental question. Is the seed dormant or dead? If it's dead, well, I'm sorry, but you've saved yourself a lot of time because you don't have to worry about breaking its dormancy. How do we do this? All right. Most of you are familiar with, or some of you are familiar with the tetrazoleum test, which I'll show you a picture of, or a cut test. And this helps us determine whether the seed is dead or alive. Neither test can be definitive. In other words, the seeds can fool you. Yeah. So the cut test is very, very simple. This is illustrated for Spartina. I see some of my students in class sitting in the back checking out to see if I've changed my story or not. But if you cut the seed, in this case, the coleoptile will actually emerge. You can do this for things like many other grasses. Spartina works for red rice, most of the wheats and barley. It's a simple cut test. It's not something that you want to scale up. It's like, well, are my seeds viable or not? The classic is the tetrazoleum test, in which case we take the mouthful of compound 2,3,5 triphenyl tetrazoleum chloride, and we prepare it and incubate cut seeds, all right, where the cut test is a non-destructive test. In other words, you can nurse this along and get a plant to maturity with a cut test. A tetrazoleum test can be destructive, and usually is, because the formate, what you've got is the dye is being reduced by mechanisms that are still not entirely clear. Try and get money to work on that. But that the red dye precipitates and turns these cells red. And you say, oh, all I have to do is go to my friend down the road who has some tetrazoleum in the freezer and get a simple book, you know, that's the, where somebody cited how to do the tetrazoleum test, and I can cut the seed in half and do a tetrazoleum test, and I'll know if my seeds are alive or not. And you would be so wrong. You would be so terribly, terribly wrong, all right? This is one of these things, like a lot of things in manipulative biology, that looks simple, sounds simple, and the seeds will lie to you. All right? You can get false positives, particularly if you have fungal contamination. and you're only looking with the naked eye and not under the microscope, or you can get false negatives, all right? Particularly, not usually in freshly harvested seeds, but if you're exhuming seeds from a soil seed bank, a cut test will give you a beautiful seedling, and a tetrazoleum test will give you something that's white as a Halloween ghost. All right? So, do it. Do a bake sale. All right? Get the $50 you need and order the tetrazoleum handbook. Learn how to do it right. Teach your students how to do it properly. Okay? You don't store the tetrazoleum solution properly, it's going to go bad on you. How would you know? All right? If you get a bad batch of tetrazoleum, you know, Cigna sent you some weird stuff, all right, that they didn't check completely. How would you know? You have to know this stuff. Otherwise, the seeds will lie to you. You'll waste a lot of time. All right. Well, in my flow diagram, I guess I should go back here. I thought I had an extra one in there. Maybe not. All right, so poor quality or handling, you have low viability, all right, or you've got a recalcitrant seed or maybe an intermediate seed that you weren't aware of, and you should make friends with Uncle Sid, okay? Uncle Sid is provided by our friends at Q. There is no such thing as a definitive database. So if you're looking for God's truth, you'll excuse my license, about a complete database for seeds, you will not find it. All right, you will find contradictions and this and that, and so you have to consult several. Yeah, I know that you'd replicate an experiment, right? So you're going to invest a lot in these seeds. All right, so let's do it. Seed Information Database, SID, all right? And it's useful for a variety of sources. What you do is you scroll down on this page, and it says search the Seed Information Database. You don't need to be a taxonomist to do this, all right? All you have to know is the genus, and preferably the species, but it's not necessary, the genus of the seed that you're curious about, and you hit the button, right? And there it is, 15 records found. And it will tell you if a species is recalcitrant or not. This can be also particularly helpful because you have a species for which there is no information. It happens, all right? What you can do is take a species for which there's known information, do a little research in the molecular literature, all right? So make sure you know that molecular information is valuable. Cohn said so, yeah? And you can see a molecular taxonomy, and you say, what is the species that's the closest to mine and that where we know something, and try it. Sometimes you get the answer right away, sometimes you have to fiddle. I'll tell you a little bit about what we do when we have to fiddle. So, SID is important. It is an important toolbox, all right? It's modern, it's contemporary, it's hip, it's on the web, and it's backed by the full faith and intellectual credit of Q at Wakehurst Place, which to me is very reassuring. Not that they're perfect, but it's good enough. All right, so what is dormancy? We're going to be dealing with it, all right? Everybody has a slightly different view. The important thing for me is that it's a post-harvest period of developmental arrest. All right? Now, granted, a maize kernel does not germinate on the ear unless it's viviparous. In other words, unless it spontaneously germinates on the ear. My preference is not to call that dormancy, a lack of vivipary or developmental arrest, because otherwise it gets too confusing. I can remember getting overstimulated when I first started out in the dormancy business, discovering Mangelsdorf's old work on corn genetics. And he was talking about dormancy in maize. This is like 1935 stuff, and I was getting all overstimulated because one thing I knew how to do was to make maize crosses as a result of my experience in graduate school. So I said, hot dog, I never knew this before. And I went, and it turned out he was talking about quiescence. In other words, a dry seed doesn't germinate. All right? So one has to be careful here. You can't talk about delayed germination. So I've read papers by people who should know better. They're not in this room, all right, so don't look around, that say that a 10-hour lag in germination, and I'll give you the species of a tobacco species, that 10 hours represents dormancy. And in my humble, well, not so humble opinion, it's hogwash. All right, all the seeds germinate 100%. The only difference is one population germinates 10 hours more slowly. What's wrong with saying delayed germination? That's a whole different thing. All right, it works for me. But if the seeds germinate 100%, they can't be dormant. Either they germinate or they don't. All right, so for art's sake, dormancy is important for the seed. Maybe a pain in the neck for you, but it's important for a seed. This is part of the toolkit that seeds have to maximize their ability to successfully establish and reproduce. All right? You don't want some endangered species germinating in the dead of winter if that cold temperature is going to kill it. All right? Nature has figured this out. Dormancy is dynamic. I think we've heard a little bit about this before from Dr. Walters. Seeds exhibit different intensities or depths of dormancy, even though we don't really know what they are at the molecular level, we can infer this from physiological work. And even genetics seems to indicate that there are multiple blocks to germination, whose nature is still a matter of active debate. All right. What you should know in terms of trying to solve a practical problem, remember we are dealing with a practical problem, is that dormancy is a two-compartment, not a two-component, but a two-compartment system. There is the embryo, all right, and there are the covering structures. One might be the testa, the endosperm, the pericarp, but a variety of things. But basically, the way that the seed is packaged, all right, and that there is communication between these two. In extreme cases, all right? So that unless the right signals are received in both compartments, this seed laughs at you and does not germinate, all right? Other cases, all you have to do is scratch the seed coat and you get a beautiful germination response. Other times, the seed coat is so weak, all you have to do is apply something like gibberellic acid, the embryo elongates very nicely, and pushes through the covering structure. So what you've got is physical restraint by the radical, by the covering structures to radical growth. It's holding it in, all right? It's a matter of material science in a sense. And what we've got is enzymes produced that weaken this covering structure, all right? That's one thing. And then there's the elongation of the radical, all right? Two separate things can be under two sets of genetic control and sometimes interact. So it's going to depend on the species. This makes this means that one can extrapolate from one species to another, but carefully. Okay. So types of primary dormancy. If you had a seed class, you know this, right? Yeah, there we go. I got some nods in the back. Physical dormancy, this is very, very simple. Water impermeable seed coats. How it actually forms is still somewhat of a mystery. All right, we know some details for certain types of Arabidopsis, but for real seeds, it's still somewhat of a mystery. All right, we've got coat-imposed dormancy, which is kind of a variant. In this case, the seeds take up water, but the coat is so resistant to the force of the radical, which is weak, that the seeds remain dormant. So covering structures restrict axis growth. Rudimentary embryo, not everybody agrees with this classification. This would be something like orchids, where you have an undifferentiated embryo when the seeds dehiss from the mother plant. And there's that wonderful grab egg, physiological dormancy, which I'll talk about a little bit more. And thanks to the Baskins, we have a whole series of variations called morphophysiological dormancy. So this is not a combination of different dormancy types. This is kind of like a little bit of this and a little bit of that. What you've got is embryo growth that's arrested before the seed is mature, all right? So that all the parts are there, you can see it. You can see differentiation of the root, differentiation of the shoot, but it hasn't elongated sufficiently. And what we need is an environmental signal to trigger it to elongate within the seed cavity, and then another signal to trigger its germination out into the outside world. Sometimes these signals are separated by an entire growing year. All right, so that's a real challenge, all right? And there's virtually nothing known about this at the molecular level, so far as I know. All right, so back to our system. So we've ruled out death, And then the next question is, does it take up water? If it doesn't, well, scratch it. All right? Get a couple of sandpaper blocks, pick whatever strength you want, and just rub your seeds gently together. All right, you can tell if they don't take up water. They'll sit there. You can weigh them, put them on a moist substrate, come back 2 days later, and if they haven't gained any weight, they haven't taken up water. All right? You can mess that up, all right, but most people don't. You can scratch this, all right, with sandpaper, which is the safest way as far as I'm concerned. You may read about acid scarification and everything. Leave that to the pros and the people who live in the fast lane. All right? You can do terrible things with acid scarification, including heat kill your seeds. All right? Leave nice acid burns at various parts of your body. You don't have to go that far. Don't do it. All right. So there are a variety of dormancy breaking tricks. And as you'll see, some of these have relation to real life. We talk about dry after ripening. We could talk, right, for days about dry after ripening. We have at LSU. Basically, the drier the seed, the faster they lose dormancy. In the dry state, they're just sitting there. You're doing nothing except leaving them alone, and dormancy disappears. However, if you get them too dry, they'll slow down. All right? And no one has really used those parameters to do some serious physiology and molecular biology, because what you've got is a control, an inbuilt control in the system. Gibberellic acid, you know, is time-tested. You can use it very, very nicely. My preference is to say a pulse can be more effective. In other words, it's a drug, ladies and gentlemen. When you contact living tissue with a drug, all right, you're going to overdose it. All right, try a day, try a 2 days, take it off, all right, rinse it, see what happens. All right, the other thing that I would recommend is that you adjust the pH, all right? It's not just me. Go back, Cees Carson, who's one of the gods of European seed biology, showed very, very definitively that adjusting the pH, well, you need just a weak acid, right, gibberellic acid, so if you lower the pH, you protonate it, it goes in easier. All right, be reasonable, do it my way. Moist chile, all right, this is one type of stratification, or you have various combinations of light, nitrate, and moist chile. In a lot of cases, one of these will not be effective, all right, so that what you need is a combination. You'll see why this works, how we can rationalize why it works. Liquid smoke from the store works. You don't need a trash barrel of debris, all right, I mean, unless you want to make something that, you know, sparks envy in your friends, say, oh, that's a still for smoke. He's making freshly made liquid smoke. You can go to the grocery store and get the products and dilute it. The downside is that you won't know what's in there unless you do the HPLC yourself, because the companies will not tell you what's in their liquid smoke. Okay? Personally, after seeing what's in there from various publications, I would never put the stuff on any of my food, all right? But it's good for breaking dormancy to see. It's pharmacology at its worst, all right? There are many others which I can talk about and which you'll read about in the literature, which are more particular with a variety of safety issues. So a dramatic example is cyanide, either in the aqueous or gaseous form, will work very nicely. And I am evidence to say that you can survive this if you do this carefully. All right, well, what do these really relate to? What we find when we look at this and we say, why do seeds respond to this, is that what we've got is what Dr. Walters has referred to as a timekeeper. Yeah, that seeds are wonderful keepers and keen perceptors of their environment. And they measure this in a variety of ways, which we know in a very descriptive way, but which we can't talk about in any kind of a rigorous mechanistic way. So that dry after ripening can be looked at as a soil moisture and temperature sensor. Low or high temperature stratification, and yet high temperature can also serve as a dormancy breaking treatment. This is a seasonal or soil moisture sensor. All right, and you say, well, seasonal, I understand soil moisture. I believe it was Dr. Walters, a very young Dr. Walters, that showed that stratification only works when the moisture content of the seeds is so high. In other words, it doesn't work with dry seeds. All right, am I quoting that correctly? By gosh, am I like a steel trap? Alternating temperatures, again, seasonal and depth sensors, non-hormonal chemicals. All right, these are soil fertility indicators such as nitrite. or nitrate, and post-fire, what are called carrakins now, but which, if you've been around for a while, they're butanolide, a.k.a. liquid smoke. It's all the same class of compounds. And then light, which is a soil depth and gap sensor. And so what you've got is a series of sensors that allow the seed to say, where am I, and are the odds favoring me, favoring germination of myself, so that I will go on and survive and produce another generation of seeds. I mean, because that's what the seed's in it for. They don't care about you. They don't care if you live or die. All right? They want to produce the next generation of seeds. Sometimes these things can interact. All right? Just an example here from our work. This is with red rice. So we dry after ripening at 30 degrees Celsius in dry storage for 0 and 1 week, and then we germinate the seed at 1 degree, 5C, 15C, 30 degrees C for 2 weeks. Okay? And you can see that not too much has happened. All right? But if we do germination after an additional 2 weeks at 30 degrees C, so we take the 1C seeds that have been sitting there for 2 weeks, now transfer them to 30 degrees C, we get... We've never gotten more than 50%, but we haven't played with it in years. But this is very, very reproducible. So what we have is an interaction between dry after ripening and the efficacy of cold stratification. And this actually resolves a small but cone-satisfying bit of divergence in the literature. Eric Roberts, who some of you may know or have heard of, claimed that stratification broke dormancy of rice, which I never really believed until I saw this. He wasn't dealing with weedy rice like we are, and I think, oh, it's an interaction between these two. GA sensitivity can also change with dry after ripening and other dormancy-breaking treatments. So a little bit of research is important. All right, now, I don't want to be a seed biologist. What's wrong with you? Anyway, I don't want to spend a lot of time fiddling with this. And look, as a smart researcher, if somebody has already figured it out, why should you go and do it again? I mean, unless you have more time than I have. There are a variety of sources to give you information, and these sources are critical because many of the references that you need, you won't find in PDF form. You may actually have to go to the library. You remember where that is. Okay? Walk to the library. Make sure the library is open. Okay? But what you can have on your desk is Baskin and Baskin. Carol Baskin's mind is such a vast steel trap, I can't tell you. She knows stuff that it's like, oh, I could go on for days. Two that are lesser known, but this is also good because it goes back and talks about the older literature. Right, which is when people had the time and were actually given money to figure out problems like this, is Anderson's Guide to the Practical Methods of Propagating Weeds in Other Plants. And the current editors are Bueller and Hoffman. It's published by the Weed Science Society, shameless plug, and it's a good, useful book. And also there's the Association of Official Seed Analysts Rules for Seed Testing, which will give you a variety of guidelines as to... how to germinate more common seeds. Yeah? So when these published resources fail, what can I do? All right? If you're a graduate student, right, you panic. The secrets are safe with me. All right? You don't have to panic, just a little bit. If it makes you feel better, it's okay. You can say, and you can ask, in nature, when are these seeds shed? In other words, what I'm asking you to do is think like a seed. Right? There are five people in this room who know that I'm not being crazy when I say that, and they're all veterans of my seed physiology class, all right, just sitting in the back. Think like a seed. When are the seeds shed? When are the seedlings first observed in nature, in the real world? Okay? How's the weather? What happened? How much rainfall was there? What were the depths of temperature? A lot of the time, particularly in areas of the United States, there's weather data. Sometimes it's on the web. You don't even have to know somebody to ask. All right, just make sure it's close enough. And from that, you may be able to infer what will work for you. I'm not guaranteeing it. All right? The other thing that you can do is to ask what other seedlings, in other words, other plants, emerge at the same time. And maybe the dormancy tricks have been worked out for those. Right? So there are all any number of things. Again, I mentioned going into SIDS, looking for species within the same genus, although that doesn't always work, as a clue for what might work. All right? So what data are available for closely related taxonomic species? All right, so big question. Should dormancy be broken before storage for gene or seed conservation? From my general experience, so this is very, very subjective, the answer would be no. All right? Dormant seeds have evolved to survive the rigors of nature in the wild. All right? We have weedy rice that has germinated after being buried in under a levee, completely rainy Louisiana conditions for 30 years. All right? This would kill a soybean seed, ladies and gentlemen. This would obliterate maize. All right? So wild seeds, not all of them, but many species have evolved to survive the rigors and insecurity of nature. All right? Think like a seed. All right? Let nature tell you what's going on. Unless there's data that says for your particular species, not so fast. All right? But you would be surprised. There's very little physiological work on saying or substantiating whether this is correct. In other words, should you leave the seeds in the dormant state before you store them? All right, most people would say subjectively from their experience, no. But if you're looking for rigorous experiments, there are only a few, and the ones that I'm familiar with are compromised in one way or another, so I don't want to quote them. I will give you some information about them if you're interested later. All right, so finally, should dormancy be broken before attempting restoration? It's always about questions, ladies and gentlemen. What are your goals for that project? Okay, if you want rapid plant coverage, by all means, break dormancy. You want to get rapid and uniform germination, break dormancy. But if you want to recreate a natural landscape, whatever that might be for you, maybe not. So this, and there's no guidelines here except for your experience and thinking about the system that you're dealing with, consulting with ecologists, and learning what you can about the flora of the that you're trying to restore. All right? So in the ideal state, and it's in theory, so you'd sow dormant seeds at the time of natural dispersal, right? That's when nature lets them go. And then you'd shed non-dormant seeds at the time when the seedlings from prior observations are emerge from the soil. So our take-home message is this. How are we doing? Just fine.
Yeah, 30 minutes.
Just fine. Our take-home message is know your seed, ladies and gentlemen. There's no substitute for this. The literature may be old. Let me tell you, all right? A 1923 reference that helps you is a good article. Yeah? Just because it's old, all right, doesn't mean it's bad or it's not relevant. Just because it's not about, you know, it's, some of you major professors know back in the day when PDFs were just coming in, you could always tell when a student was trying to cut corners, because their literature review stopped in 1978, you know, and so the journals hadn't done PDFs and the earlier stuff, and so it's like all their citations. So whatever field they were working on, you know, the work began in 1978. All right? So look, what's out there, people have paid a price. People sacrificed part of their lives to do this stuff. Okay? It is non-professional of you to ignore it. I'm talking mostly to the graduate students. All right. There were giants in 1923. They didn't have, they didn't have pH meters. They had to do an acid-base titration. Remember those in school? All right. They didn't have a pH meter. They didn't have an ultracentrifuge. All right. They didn't have Sigma or Clone Tech to call up and say, send me, you know, X number of dollars of this, that, or the other thing. All right. It was hard to do research. Not because it was expensive, but because you have to make everything yourself. So, these people spent a lot of time thinking about the little bit of data that they got, and you should avail yourself of that, really and truly. So, are the seeds alive or dead? You check the literature, Uncle Sid, Baskin and Baskin. Step outside and look around, all right? Let nature do the talking. It's a wonderful thing. And think like a seed. What's going on, and how is the seed surviving in this, and how is it behaving in nature? With these tricks, your anxiety level will drop substantially. You will almost feel that you are in control of your experimental destiny. Don't let it go to your head. The seeds are subtler than you are. But you will be able to go on and do some interesting research in a very efficient way. And for you graduate students, you will impress your major professor. Thank you.